heroic couplets and children's literature next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Join me now for conversations with literary scholars J. Paul Hunter of the University of Chicago and Ulrich Knoffelmacher of Princeton University. Paul Hunter is here to talk about the heroic couplet, its rhyme and reason. Ulrich Knoffelmacher is also on hand to discuss children's literature as a form of dialogue between past and present selves. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. First on the show this week, Paul Hunter.
The easiest way to describe it is two rhymed lines. In English, it's a 10-beat line, a 5-beat line with 10 syllables, responding to the accentual syllabic strategies of English poetry. Uh-huh. Really just means two consecutive lines that are rhymed as a unit.
Paul Hunter teaches at the University of Chicago. He's working on a new book about the heroic couplet, its rhyme and reason, artistry and ideology. For most of us, of course, if we think of it at all, we remember the heroic couplet as little more than a moment in an undergraduate survey course, 2 5-beat lines that rhyme. But even though its very name now sounds quaint, and although it no longer dominates English verse the way it did in the time of John Dryden and Alexander Pope, the heroic couplet still leads to fresh insights into cultural landscapes, past and present.
Well, the main time that one thinks of is the late 17th, early 18th century. One thinks of names like John Dryden in the late 17th century, Alexander Pope, who undoubtedly deserves his reputation as the best poet in the couplet ever. It began to flourish earlier. You associate the couplet with figures like Ben Jonson in the reasonably early 17th century. And there certainly were couplets written even earlier than that.
Was it, if I got it right, that it was Chaucer who brought it into the English language?
Chaucer is usually credited with bringing it into the language, though he really thought of couplets in a quite different way. He probably did not construct in two-line units in the way later writers did. That is, two-line units allied to something larger, for mm-hmm. sure, but nevertheless thinking in two-line units. His couplets are much looser. He adapted them from other languages, primarily French.
Now, what do we associate the heroic couplet with, Paul Hunter? You've talked about essentially the end of the 17th, the 18th century. What kind of literary expressiveness are we talking about here?
Well, let me give you two answers. I think the popular answer to that would be we associate it with epigrams or with very short, witty sayings. We associate it with the ability to say something in a very concise, almost bumper sticker-like fashion. And it's true that couplet poets, because they're constructing in very small units,
right,
do tend to think in very witty terms, and the couplet lends itself to great wit. The other way of thinking about it, though, is to think about it in terms of its uses, and its uses to the poets of the 17th and 18th century in England were primarily public uses, primarily political poetry, poetry about the social fabric, poetry about what was going on in the culture on a day-to-day basis. Not so much with personal emotion, though certainly there are some very powerfully emotional poems written in couplets, but you associate it more with public verse. And maybe we'll talk more about this later, but I sort of resist the epigrammatic definition. I think that one of the things that's very important to see about couplets is how they fit together. They're not really conceived as complete two-line units.
Right. Well, wonderful lines from, I think they're both from Pope, whatever is right, a little learning is a dangerous thing. The temptation is to think of them as you said, bumper stickers, little verbal slingshots, and yet you're telling us that we got to understand the heroic couplet in terms of larger aesthetic or social or political enterprises, projects.
Well, one example might be Pope's famous poem called Windsor Forest, which is written as a celebration poem. It celebrates the Peace of Utrecht in 1713, a victory over the, a treaty with the French that was represented in England, at least, as a victory over the French. And Pope's poem is a celebration of the reign of Queen Anne. It's a celebration of the conclusion of the hostilities, temporary conclusion of the hostilities with France, and a celebration of English commercial dominance and sea power, a celebration of the grandeur of England as a nation, a kind of nationhood poem.
And the people who read this stuff would know this. I mean, they wouldn't have to be told with lots of footnotes and explanatory baggage what's going on here.
Obviously, we would now. Yeah. Obviously, a poem like that has to be footnoted very heavily. Right. But for those people living in the time, it was the equivalent of what they were talking about every day.
Was it the equivalent of what we call popular culture? That is to say, just the general circulation of stories and political, social issues in a people regardless of class or station.
Maybe popular culture would be a little strong because we're still talking about a relatively small portion of the reading audience. I don't want to give the impression that there was this golden age where everyone who read poetry primarily and instead of the equivalent of the newspaper, tracts and pamphlets. We're talking about a classed society. We're talking about a society which is increasingly including in its reading public, its poetry reading public, people who are not the not aristocrats, not necessarily even gentry, not traditional audience for poetry. The audience is growing, but we're still talking about a relatively small percentage of people. We're talking about, in Habermasian terms, the creation of the public sphere, so that we're talking about more and more people being involved in public affairs or the public sphere, being influenced to think about larger national matters.
Paul Hunter, we're talking about your work as a literary scholar. You teach at the University of Chicago. You're writing a book about the heroic couplet. The heroic couplet sounds like it belongs utterly in the past. Why does it deserve attention in the 1990s? And in fact, does the heroic couplet have a future apart from, you know, the kind of scholarship that you are doing?
I think the heroic couplet probably doesn't have a future in the sense that I don't imagine there's going to be a great comeback of the couplet. We still have people who write in couplets from time to time, usually in portions of poems. I mean, one thinks of in the 20th century, I suppose the famous examples are from the early part of the century. You think of Eliot writing parts of his plays, parts of long poems in couplets. Frost used the couplet. And when you think of couplet poets more recently, you're not really talking about the poets who've been terribly popular. Turner Cassidy uses the couplet a lot, J.V. Cunningham, but those are pretty esoteric tastes. That is, they have very strong fans, but you don't. It probably is not something that you're going to be reading in the pages of the New Yorker. I don't think that we have a neo-couplet movement rising on the left or right. What I do think is that to ask questions about why it is that a certain verse form, any kind of poetic form or art form, was very popular at a particular time tells us a lot about the nature of the culture and tells us a lot about the relationship between form of various kinds, artistic form of various kinds, and what else is going on in the culture. What I want to argue in the book is that the relationship between the couplet and a lot of other forms of verbal expression. One thing that I'll probably look at in a good deal of detail is the dialogue, the philosophical and political dialogue, for example. And I want to show, I think I can show, that there are some very similar kinds of formal relationships taking place in various kinds of prose forms and various other kinds of poetic forms to what actually goes on in the couplet. You asked about ideology earlier, and I think most people would probably say that the ideology of the couplet is a very conservative one. I would argue quite the opposite. I would argue that one of the things that happens in couplets is that you have the juxtaposition of difference, and you have a refusal to synthesize. You have a kind of pre-Hegelian thesis-antithesis, without a synthesis. In other words, a couplet asks you to keep opposites in your mind at the same time, often without choosing. And so it's a very good form for exploring and opening up issues rather than shutting them down.
Right. Normally we think of the couplet in terms of reason, rationality, order, structure, and it, precisely as you're saying, that which is limited and compact. And here you are presenting this with precisely the other end of the argument.
I'm saying that I think the couplet is best when it's used for longer poems that are essay poems, that are poems that are arguments that discuss. Uh-huh. I'm not saying it never chooses, but very frequently what it does is present present things in great complication. It may use the bumper sticker as a way of getting the job started, but right. It usually complicates, and instead of allowing one to settle for very simple kinds of conclusions, it asks its hearers, its readers, really to open up issues rather than shut them down. And I think that's an important thing to know in simply looking at how any particular form of poetry or any particular form of prose works at a particular time. If I'm right about this, I think it will make us look somewhat differently, not just at poetry and not just at prose as text, but it will make us look a bit differently perhaps at institutions and at other kinds of cultural structures in the 17th and 18th century.
J. Paul Hunter teaches at the University of Chicago. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a new study of the heroic couplet. Paul Hunter is the author of Before Novels, The Cultural Contexts of 18th Century English Fiction. He serves as editor of the Norton Introduction to Poetry and the Norton Introduction to Literature. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, more about literature and expressive culture. Ulrich Knoffelmacher of Princeton University is here to talk about children's literature as a form of dialogue between past and present selves.
I think they're sort of positioned at an ideal point in life, that they are still close enough to childhood, which some of us, except somebody like me, have left behind.
Right.
Yet are also entering adult life. So they're in this kind of sort of Janus-like position, an in-between position, looking backwards and looking forwards. They begin to see a kind of a richness in these texts that on one hand confirms what they had felt before, but on the other hand also ratifies it, alters it, and makes them see things anew.
Ulrich Knoffelmacher teaches at Princeton University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a new book about children's literature with special emphasis on what he terms cross-writing, work by authors who write for children and in doing so create a colloquy between past and present selves. Ulrich Knoffelmacher says that until recently, children's literature was undervalued, comparable to formerly marginalized fields such as women's literature or ethnic studies. But now that picture is changing.
What I like to remind my students is that children are future adults.
Right.
And yet children's books are written by ex-children, by adults who are ex-children. So in a
we've
way,
all been kids. Huh?
Exactly. Yeah. Although some of us will deny it and some of us will revel in it.
Us don't want to quit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think you and I share that. But it seems to me that positioning, that it's again that double kind of looking forwards and backwards,
right,
makes it uniquely interesting because it is written by adults and they come with adult preoccupations. They're looking backwards at their own lives.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that I find I'm sure you know this, one of the sort of current critical shibboleths in the literary establishment is that there are no such things as authors. There are only texts. Well, one of the things that I think, having worked now in children's literature for a while, contradicts that, because I need to know something about the childhood of a particular author. what, you know, it's important, even the very fact, is this person an only child? Was this person surrounded, as Lewis Carroll was, by adoring older and younger sisters, and therefore right. identifies with little girls and would like to be a little girl himself? Uh-huh. But other things as well, the horrible trauma that poor Rudyard Kipling suffered when he was sent to England at age 6 from India after living in India this wonderful life, the trauma that as an older person that Mark Twain suffered when his little boy died through what Mark Twain construed as a kind of negligence of his own, mm-hmm. and I think that one has to read something like The Prince and the Pauper with that in mind, that it is the short-lived life of this little monarch.
Uli, explain to our listeners how children's literature becomes the legitimate subject for serious literary scholarship. I mean, I'm not sure if it's genuine or if it's apocryphal, but I remember hearing one of my teachers say that Harriet Beecher Stowe remarked that Huckleberry Finn is not a book for little boys. Tell us about how it functions in our culture.
Well, as you know, Huckleberry Finn has been deemed by people such as Hemingway and T.S. Eliot to be the quintessential American novel,
right.
Which it is. But at the same time, it and I think that Twain intended it for a dual kind of readership of children and adults. And at the same time, it seems to be tilting more towards the adult kind of readership. But what goes on in Huckleberry Finn is something that is quintessential to children's books, and that where can we decide that Huckleberry Finn is a book that should be taught by serious Americanist literature professors in their courses, but say The Prince and the Pauper or Tom Sawyer's adventures should be taught in Kiddie Lit courses,
right.
those lesser kind of courses. You have to see the totality, it seems to me, of the effort. Huck's relationship to Jim is something that's picked up very much in a lot of children's books, where you get a child who is marginalized by society, and the child reader identifies with that because she or he is trying to be pressed into an adult garb, and the ally of this child becomes somebody who is an adult, but who's also marginalized by
right.
society.
Right.
And you get that encounter, you know, and I would say even something like as bizarre as Lewis Carroll's Cheshire Cat is this kind of, you know, we're mad here, everybody's mad, you are mad, I am mad, and it's kind of a foil to what is being what Alice is being drilled in by her elders.
Let's talk about some of these 19th century British examples that are your bread and butter, Uli Knoflmacher. You mentioned Lewis Carroll. I want you to talk about the kind of dark side of children's literature. There is the charge, for example, that although we have these charming stories for children, Lewis Carroll, Christina Rossetti, you can make a long laundry list here. We are also dealing beyond the charming and the adolescent and the childlike, we're dealing with deeply sexual and political themes that are at work here. Unpack this one for us.
Well, this is a very, very crucial question, and there's a whole book on this subject by somebody called James Kincaid about the erotic Victorian child, and his argument is, in fact, that the Victorian imagination is essentially in loving the child has a kind of eroticized dimension, and that is not just in Lewis Carroll, but you can find it in Dickens or, you know, in, mm-hmm. in Thomas Hardy.
So this goes to the age itself rather than the
particular
writer.
But it seems to me it's we tend to approach these questions sort of with a meat cleaver. And, you know, we it's
right.
either this or that.
Right.
And just as I'm trying to show that child texts partake of adult texts partake of child texts, that there are gradations and complications. So similarly, it seems to me, the very notion of pedophilia, I mean, Kincaid is in a sense arguing that it's our distortion of what constitutes the word pedophilia that makes us misread these texts, but he has his own kind of ideological axe to grind, and it seems to me that things are much, much more complicated. That Lewis Carroll, to go back to your question, Lewis Carroll certainly was interested in little boys or in little girls and in little boys who looked feminine, who had long locks, like little girls. But the Victorians had a capacity to desexualize what was highly sexual, and so that he, for instance, we now have. We look at Christmas cards. The Christmas card, by the way, is something that became prominent in the middle of the Victorian era, before people were not sending Christmas cards. Uh-huh. And there are cards of little girls who have, you know, they are in highly suggestive poses with their chemises sort of halfway down. Lewis Carroll himself took a picture of Alice called the Gypsy Girl, which almost looks like a little pornographic picture, you know, that. And yet, for the Victorians, that was an emblem of innocence. That was a pristine kind of virginal sort of state that was wholesome.
It's also deeply, unexpected, if not ironic, because we associate with the Victorians a kind of cultural puritanism that certainly we don't want to call them child pornographers, and yet the evidence is there to go back and look at this.
Yeah, and I think that puritanism goes hand, everything has a flip side. Another thing that we associate the Victorians with is sort of a repressive, authoritarian, you know, the Victorian bearded paterfamilias who is really hard on his children and so on. There have been interesting studies suggesting that quite the contrary to it. They were an extraordinarily sentimental society that almost sort of idealized the child beyond beyond recognition.
Uli, we've just seen the publication of a new book by the poet Robert Bly, who argues that we live in a nation, North America, the United States in the 1990s, for dozens of complex reasons. The nub of it is that we live in a nation of half-children, that we are not complete, that we're not adults, and yet we're not kids either. We live in a kind of middling netherworld. Does this go at all to your interest in children's literature?
It does, but it's I find it a little bit scary because what constitutes completeness, you know, for Robert Bly?
Who's to say?
Yeah, exactly. So it seems to me that from my vantage point that incompleteness is desirable. Uh-huh. That as long as we retain something of the child as adults.
That is to say, the process.
The process, as long as we can remember. So much of what we do is a repression, really, of energies and powers that we had as children, which I think these writers are trying to recapture. So if we are going to say, well, we're only still in a half-formed stage, we've got to move on to this full kind of state of masculinity and, you know, beat some drums and really
that,
become
that sounds
become
like
adult.
American. That sounds like American political triumphalism.
Exactly. And so that's a little worrisome to me.
Uli, a footnote to our conversation. Do you have a favorite document, text in children's literature that you enjoyed as a kid that you read to your kids? Tell us about that very quickly.
Well, I was afraid you were going to ask me that question. the trouble I have is whenever I teach a particular work or when I write about a particular work, that work becomes my favorite.
Uh-huh. So you got lots of them.
So I got lots of them, and I think it would be hard to pinpoint one over others. But I obviously have read many of these stories to my children, but usually what I try to do is to tap the creativity of my children and have them collaborate with me in making up stories.
You're making the best assumptions about not only human nature, but about the nature of children's nature. Am I right?
Yeah, I guess so.
And a footnote to a footnote, Uli Knoflmacher. Do you believe that, now this is a serious question, do you believe that we all have a child within and I take it that you do, given the kind of literary study that you're engaged in?
I do believe we have all the child within, and I think that we have many children within us. And I think, again, it's too simple to say there is this one child. You know, there is in us, a pre-verbal baby, you know, and then it goes all the way through adolescence. I mean, we've been talking about children's literature, and we have not made a distinction between what librarians would distinguish between juvenile literature for adolescents and children's literature, which is clearly, you know, very, very different. So we have an adolescent within us. We have children at various ages, and they're all sort of vying for possession. And when we act irrationally sometimes, or in, you know, this shows that I'm not totally defending the immaturity of the child in immature ways. I think that these children are also speaking through the adult. So we can never really shed it, much as we would like to sometimes.
Ulrich Knoffelmacher is a professor of English at Princeton University. He's the author of books about religion and Victorian culture and the novels of George Eliot and Emily Bronte. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Ulrich Knoffelmacher worked on a new book about children's literature entitled Ventures into Childland, Fairy Tales, Femininity, and the Victorians, forthcoming from the University of Chicago Press. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this program. Listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. For an audio tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 860. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ga.unc.edu. Visit our site on the internet at www.nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week on Soundings, novelist and poet Fred Chappell. He'll be here with readings and conversation about his new novel, Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You. Finally, a program note. A few cabins remain on the National Humanities Center study session to the Greek islands and Turkey aboard the exclusively chartered four-masted yacht Sea Cloud. Information provided 1-888-650-TOUR. That's 1-888-650-8687. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.